Translation: once upon a time when Brahma was thinking of how to create the worlds, as in the past millennium, the four Vedas, which contain all varieties of knowledge, became manifested from his four mouths. Purport: as a fire can consume anything and everything without being contaminated, so by the grace of the Lord, the fire of Brahma's greatness consumes his desire for the sinful act of sex with his daughter. The Vedas are the source of all knowledge, and they were first revealed to Brahma by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, while Brahma was thinking of recreating the material world. Brahma is powerful by dint of his devotional service unto the Lord, and the Lord is always ready to forgive his devotee if by chance he falls down from the noble path of devotional service. Srimad Bhagavatam confirms this as follows: Svapadamu lamba jata priyasya Jagvanya bhavasya hari paresha vikarmayat chot patitam katanchit dunoti sarvam hridi sannavishta. Any person who is engaged 100% in the transcendental loving service of the Lord at his lotus feet is very dear to the personality of Godhead Hari, and the Lord, being situated in the heart of the devotee, excuses all kinds of sins committed by chance. It was never expected that a great personality like Brahma would ever think of sex indulgence with his daughter. The example shown by Brahma only suggests that the power of material nature is so strong it can act upon everyone, even Brahma. Brahma was saved by the mercy of the Lord with a little punishment. But by the grace of the Lord, he did not lose his prestige as the great Brahma. So this is a chapter on the story of creation. Actually, this is sub-creation. We have the primary creation where Mahavishnu glances and agitates Prakriti to turn into Mahatattva and Ahankara and create the material elements. And Vishnu injects the jivas into this substance Prakriti. And through this we get the elements which form into universes. And then Garbhadakshay, Vishnu enters, and from his navel sprouts Brahma, and Brahma takes the elements. And as stated in this verse, he's saying, how can I create the... And of course, not only creates the planets, he also creates all the bodies for all the jivas that have been injected into this material world. So that's called the visarga, or the sub-creation. So in other words, the Lord does the initial creation of the elements, and then Brahma puts the elements together to perform, to make... lokas, or planets, and bodies for living entities. So, these are two topics out of the 10 topics which are discussed in Srimad Bhagavatam. Wow. Ultimately, of course, the final topic is asraya, or shelter, or cause. And that cause is, according to Bhagavatam, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. So he's the final cause. And this is the, I can say, the main topic of Bhagavatam discussed in the 10th canto, and all other topics ultimately must relate to that asraya Krishna. So therefore, the Mahavishnu creates, Brahma creates, etc. But Mahavishnu is an expansion from Shankarshan, Shankarshan is an expansion from Krishna. So ultimately everything goes back to Krishna. He is the cause of all causes. So all of these discussions we hear, descriptions we see here of creation and sub-creation, etc., are there because just to indicate the ultimate cause of all causes. Of course, the cause of all causes, though he creates the material world, etc., is actually separate from the creation of the material world. And that's why Krishna acts through expansions. He doesn't personally come with his flute and his blue color and his golden dhoti or whatever and then start making worlds, etc. He doesn't do anything personally. Huh? Of course, even Vishnu doesn't do things personally. Mahavishnu glances. He doesn't touch Prakriti at all. But anyway, Krishna is far away from that, and even the Vishnu forms in the spiritual world are completely separate from the material creation. So they take place by the personal intervention of the Lord, but at the same time the Lord is completely separate in the spiritual world. So that is why we have these different expansions taking place, to show that the creation itself, though from our point of view it is quite grand and fantastic, still it is nothing in comparison to the spiritual world. And it's got nothing to do with the spiritual world ultimately, because he's involved in pastimes with his devotees in the spiritual world, and it's for the blissful. So he's got nothing to do with the material world in one sense. But at the same time, because he is all compassionate and all knowledgeable, he does involve himself in this world. So he does this through his expansions, like Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Kshiradakshaya Vishnu. And in this way, he monitors everything in the material world through expansion. So that's how everything takes place. So we will sometimes wonder why we have so many cantos involved in these technical aspects of elements and creation and sub-creation and species of life, etc. It is a little bit off the subject, because ultimately we're interested in Krishna and his pastimes in the spiritual world, but we get to deal with all these other topics for 9 cantos, some of which are very technical. No. And of course they're dealing with material things like material bodies, material planets, and material elements. So then what's this got to do with spiritual life? We're trying to get out of here. So one answer, of course, is that for people in the material world, they often wonder, well, how is this material world created? How is my body created? So we have to give an answer to that. So this is probably a more immediate question for most people. First we say, well, I'm an Atma, I'm not the body. And then there's the Supreme Lord, who's the Supreme Atma and the Supreme Spiritual Entity. And we can give descriptions of him, as we do in Bhagavatam. But still, people are wondering in the material world, well, how did I get here, and how is this world created, and how is the Lord related to my material body? So then to answer those questions, we have all of these discussions. And we'll see that such a question is prominent among all people. And they ask about creation. And even scientists are asking about creation. How did this world come about? How do animals come about? And they have their answers, like evolution and Big Bang and whatever. So we get all sorts of questions like this from not only people involved in religion and philosophy, but also people involved in science. They're asking this question: where did everything come from? How did this world get here? How are things created? So, of course, in answer to that, then, we do have these descriptions of material world and how it takes place. On a more philosophical level, the question arises, how does matter relate to a Supreme Lord who is not matter, who is spiritual? And how can they relate at all? Because they're completely different. And why does he create matter at all? Because it's completely unconscious and low and full of ignorance, etc. So how does the Lord create such an inferior thing as the material world with the material bodies full of ignorance? So that's another question, which is all religions also have to deal with. How does God relate to the material world if he's all perfect and the world is so imperfect? So why is there evil in the world? We have a material world made out of matter, and then we have human beings, and they're killing each other and cheating each other and whatever, and animals are killing each other, whatever. How does God create such a violent world? So these are questions that have to be answered by any philosophy or any religion that talks about God, who's an all-perfect being. So we have to have answers to those questions, and various philosophies and religions try to answer, but maybe not so satisfactorily. And because of that, people also lose faith. So these questions are there, and of course Bhagavatam also answers all of this. And we see how the Lord is involved in creation, but indirectly through his expansions of Mahavishnu, Garbhadaksha Vishnu, Kshiradaksha Vishnu. And also, even they do not touch anything in the material world. Mahavishnu glances. Garbhadaksha Vishnu enters, but he's kind of lying down there sleeping on the Garbhadak ocean. And then out of his navel everything comes, so he's still a little bit distant from it. And then we have Kshiradaksha Vishnu on the milk ocean, and he enters into each jiva in the material world, but still, he's untouched. So Paramatma in the heart is there, but he's not contaminated. We have Paramatma in all the devatas and all the human beings and all the demons and all the animals and all the plants, but still completely untouched. So the Lord, by his inconceivable energy, can expand himself into the material world with his form intact and not be contaminated by anything, even for the most low, wicked living entities, whatever they are. He's still in there, within them, but he's not contaminated at all. So therefore, the Lord can penetrate everything and not be contaminated, which means that he is not like anything in the material world. If I make a pot with the, out of clay, and then my hands get dirty. So I get a little contaminated by working with the clay. And if I make the pot and it develops a crack, then I get blamed for the crack in the pot. So we have this material world with all of its ignorance and tamagun and whatever, and then it has all sorts of faults in it, we see. And then Lord gets blamed for that. But the answer is that, no, this is not the Lord's doing. This is the doing of the jivas. All the imperfections we see in the material world are caused by the jivas, particularly the human being. With their great intelligence, the human beings disturb the workings of material nature. And that's where we start getting problems. All the violence and all the disturbances and all the weather and whatever, we get all the problems in nature taking place because of the human beings. So, how is that possible? Because, and then we have this explanation that Lord is perfect, jivas are also conscious, but not perfect. So they're not exactly like the Supreme Lord, even though they are similar. Jivas in the material world are very unlike the Lord because they do all these violent activities, whenever full of greed and anger and lust. Jivas in the spiritual world, on the other hand, are like the Lord. They get bodies like the Lord, the Sarupya. They live in the same planet, Salokya. They have powers like the Lord, Shashti. So they're very like the Lord. And there's no violence there, there's no problems, no lust, anger, greed, anything there. So the jivas can be either way. That's why they're called tatashta. They can be fully spiritual, or they can cover themselves with material bodies and be the worst demons. So this is the nature of the jiva. And it's because of these jivas that we get all the problems in the material world. So the Bhagavatam discusses how the Lord makes the world according to a certain plan. And he even puts safeguards in there in the form of Brahma as the creator. He, with his intelligence, he has to create everything for all the bodies, so there's no mistakes. And then he has devatas there to put control from sattva-gun and regulate everything. And according to the jivas, if they, the human beings, if they do their sacrifices properly, they get the rewards and they can maintain themselves very nicely. And he provides sages to give wisdom. Yeah? And he provides manus and their descendants to rule over and establish varnashram dharma and to establish the process of bhakti. So these are some of the ways in which the Lord tries to keep the balance within the material world. Nevertheless, the world itself is imperfect. It's made of gunas, and they're always out of balance. So sometimes sattva is prominent, sometimes rajas is prominent, sometimes tamaguna is prominent. And accordingly, sometimes if tama and rajas are prominent, the demons get real strong. Materialists get very strong, and they start attacking the people in sattva. They attack the David as planets, like Hiranyakasipu or Bali, or attack, and they may overcome for some time. And so we get all these conflicts taking place within the universe at all times. This is the nature of matter. It's got these gunas, which don't exist in the spiritual world. That's why we say that bhakti is nirguna. Nistragunya bhavarjuna, get beyond the gunas, do bhakti. So, because of these gunas of prakriti, we get all these irregularities and changes taking place. So, the Lord put some controls there. Not only with the sages and the devatas and the manus, the Lord also comes personally. He comes as avatars. So we have a whole description throughout the nine cantos of all the different avatars from Svayambhuva Manvantara up through the day of Brahma. In every period, the Lord appears as some avatars. And of course, he's also appearing as yuga avatars in every yuga to restore the balance of things. So, in other words, the Lord does care about the living entities in the material world also, and therefore he appears in these ways. Not only that, the Lord also gives the process of bhakti. Bhakti is also part of the spiritual world. Krishna has his internal energy, his antaranga shakti or chit shakti, sarup shakti in the spiritual world. Part of that sarup shakti, that is the Hlidini and samvit shaktis, manifests bhakti and prema. So, the Lord puts that bhakti in the material world through the devotees. So it is actually nirguna, beyond the material world, but the Lord puts bhakti in the material world. One of the forms of bhakti in the material world is name of the Lord, Nam Sankirtan, type of bhakti. It is also transcendental. In fact, Nam Sankirtan is the easiest access to the spiritual world of all the forms of bhakti. So, Nam is also this internal energy of the Lord manifested in the material world, available for everybody. And of course, this is illustrated in the story of Ajamil. Ajamil was, you know, we're a sinful person, but he chanted the name of the Lord, even accidentally, not with devotion, and was saved from the Yamadutas. So, the Lord is manifested in so many ways in this material world. One is through the process of bhakti and name of the Lord. So in this way, the Lord takes care of the living entities in this material world. So thus, all these descriptions are there just to show that the Lord is present and active in one sense, not just witnessing everything, but he's quite active in maintaining the balance and also delivering the jivas from the material world through the process of bhakti and nam sankirtan. So, in this way, we cannot accuse the Lord of being indifferent to the material world or being contaminated by the material world. Any contamination or disturbance that takes place is not because the Lord has imperfectly made the world, but because the jivas disturb that, and they cause all the problems. So that answers that type of question. So, ultimately, the Lord's purpose of the material world is not to watch the jivas suffering, but to get the jivas out of the suffering, to get them out of their maya, their mistaken ideas about everything and all the violence that they create. And then he gives processes for that, karma yoga, jnana yoga, astanga yoga, and bhakti yoga. So the ultimate process there is bhakti yoga, which is the Sarup Shakti of the Lord. The other processes belong to the gunas, so they're not so perfect. So jnana gives rise, it comes from sattva gun, and karma yoga from tamagun rajagun combinations. So, but they're for people in the material world that don't aspire to get out. So they get this karma yoga and they deal with the gunas. When they want to get out, then they take shelter of sattva gun, practice jnana. But the purpose of the Lord is ultimately to get everyone to the spiritual world. Some, of course, don't want that. They just want a simple solution, get out of the material world, so he gives them Brahman through jnana or astanga yoga. And those who actually get the mercy of devotees and understand the real truth and they read the Bhagavatam, then they aspire for spiritual world with spiritual bodies. So that is so they get that through the process of bhakti. Yeah. So that's why we have all these descriptions here, just to answer such questions. In this purport, Prabhupada mentions about Brahma, and Brahma was very sinful, but the Lord forgave him. In spite of it was a very great sin, because he ran after his daughter, which in the modern world is like scandalous. But this is one of the principles of bhakti also. The Lord is so attracted to the devotee that even if the devotee commits a sin, the Lord doesn't mind too much. But there's some conditions to that. So we have the verse in Bhagavad Gita that the sudarachara, which means a person who has committed the worst, not a bad activity, but the worst activity. Not durachara is bad, and sudara means very bad, very, very bad. So he's committed a very sinful activity. And then Krishna says, well, he's still my devotee. I consider him still to be my devotee, after all of that. But there is a little condition there. It's not that the devotee is continually doing worse sinful activities and then going doing a little bhakti and coming back and doing some more sinful activities. So that's why Prabhupada says it's like accidental, or by chance he commits the sin. So it's not that he's intentionally doing it and then doing bhakti to cover it up or cancel the influence. If that happens, it's one of the offenses to the name, committing sinful activities in the strength of chanting the holy name or doing bhakti. So then it becomes worse. It doesn't cancel out your sin at all. That makes it worse. And it doesn't get the forgiveness of the Lord also. In that sense, the Lord rejects the person. So, but if the devotee happens to commit a sinful activity, even a very sinful activity, and of course, after he does it, he regrets it and stops and continues his bhakti, his devotional service, under that condition, then the Lord forgives. So, in other words, sin is there, and sin is basically violence against other living entities. And from that we get all sorts of suffering and bad karma. And definitely it's disturbing for the living entity, and therefore we get all these bad reactions, so we don't do it again. And we know the devotee is not supposed to be violent and indulge in these sinful activities. He's compassionate to all living entities. He doesn't want to see anybody suffer. So it's one level, and therefore we get punishment in the form of suffering for all these sinful activities. But if a person takes to the process of bhakti, if he's doing sadhana bhakti during that process, he is not completely pure. He still has anartas, and the process of bhakti is anarta nivritti, to destroy the anartas, which may cause a sinful activity. It's going to take time. So the devotee starts a sadhana and goes through nishta and ruchi and asakti and gets to bhava. So in that process, which takes time, there are anartas still. And they're gradually getting decreased. But anytime something can spring up and cause a problem. So we see Bharat Maharaj was in bhava stage, and then he got attracted to a deer, and then he stopped worshipping the Lord, even though he saw the Lord directly and had ecstatic symptoms. He forgot the Lord, and he worshipped the deer instead, and then he became a deer because he remembered the deer at death. So he fell from his position. So even in bhava, an artist can rise up and cause problem. What to speak of lower levels? So, if these mistakes arise somehow or other, they happen, still the Lord doesn't forget the devotees. He's always there to help the devotees. So that's why he says that even if you're in the most sinful activity, I still forgive you. Because he understands that anarthas are there, and due to the anarthas, when you're practicing, this can happen. But he still recognizes that person as a devotee. So this is the compassionate nature of the Lord in relation to those practicing bhakti. If you're not practicing bhakti, then of course a sin is a sin and you get your karma or whatever. The Lord doesn't really involve in that. But we see that the process of bhakti itself destroys all sinful reactions. It also destroys the propensity to commit sinful actions. But nevertheless, we're going through this process of purification, so along the way we can commit sins, and then the Lord also forgives that. So this is the nature of the Lord. What he does not forgive is offense. So he forgives sins, but not offense. So what is the difference? Offense is also violence, but it's violence against devotees, not normal living entities, or violence against Supreme Lord himself, or the process of bhakti. So if the violence is against ordinary living entities or anything in the material world, fine, that's a sin, and Lord is willing to forgive if you do it once or whatever. And you don't exploit the process for doing more. But if you do intentionally, you have hostility and show your hostility towards the Lord and the devotee and the process of bhakti and the chanting of the holy name, then that's offense. And the Lord does not forgive that. Why? Because he's so attached to the devotees and the process of bhakti and the holy name that if you start offending that, then he's very disturbed. If it's just normal living entities, fine, he can forgive that. But if you attack the devotees especially, then very bad. So that is why the offense against the devotee is called the mad elephant offense in Chaitanya Charitamrita, because what does the mad elephant do? It can come into your garden and trample on it nicely without any reason, and your bhakti creeper is finished. So that is, of all the aparads, the Vaishnava aparad is the worst. And compared to that, when he says sudaracha, very bad activity you do, still the Lord says you're my devotee. So if you have to murder a person or something by accident, kill a person by accident or whatever, still, Lord forgives. But if you do something against a devotee, no, he doesn't forgive. So that's how this principle works. Yes, for normal sinful activities, the Lord doesn't consider it too much. And rather, he puts emphasis upon the bhakti that you're doing. But when you commit aparad, especially aparad against devotees, actually you're attacking the devotee, you're attacking bhakti, you're attacking the Supreme Lord. So it defeats the whole process of bhakti itself. So how can the Lord be merciful to you when you're destroying bhakti? So, therefore, very bad effects for that. So, in this case, Brahma was forgiven. Even he was running after his daughter and whatever. So, of course, Prabhupada points out here that Brahma was a great devotee. It wasn't he was just, you know, some neophyte or whatever. He's a great exalted devotee also, but as I said, Bharat was in bhava stage, and you know this maya can arise there. So it arose in Brahma. So this shows that for anyone in the material world, they have to be very careful, even if they're devotees, because anartha can arise somehow or other, unless you're in the highest position. So this happens to Brahma, so it's a nice warning for us try to avoid these taking risks. and thus committing sinful activity. But, of course, more serious than that, of course, is the aparads. So that's why every morning we recite the 10 aparads. So we just put it in our head. We don't have the aparads like killing people and whatever, but we do have the aparads, don't offend the devotees. Because it's more serious thing. It destroys your bhakti. So by sinful activity, you get karma. Yeah? So you can get suffering in next life, get a bad birth, become an animal or a plant or whatever. So that's one type of degradation. By committing aparad, particularly the Vaishnava aparad, you destroy bhakti. So that's even worse for the devotee. He doesn't care about the pains of hell, but does care about bhakti getting destroyed. Yeah. So for the devotee, then the aparad is much more serious. And for Krishna also, the aparad is serious. So we have to be careful of that. I think I'm supposed to end now. It's 8:30. Any question? Yeah. So, yes, kama, krodha are related to the gunas, but we don't see that water becomes angry or water itself, has these emotions or whatever. So these anarthas that we find in the human being are particular for living creatures that have gross bodies and subtle bodies in the mind. And the fault of the jiva, we can say, is related to prakriti because he takes advantage of prakriti for his enjoyment. The basic fault of the jivas in the material world is they choose to not recognize the Supreme Lord as a master. And instead, they want to enjoy, not give enjoyment to the Lord, but take enjoyment for themselves. And the only way they can do that is to get a material body and try to enjoy matter. And then this gives rise to karma and lust, anger, greed, etc. So it has to do with the choice of the jiva to be separate from the Lord. That's called his ignorance, and thus enjoy separately. So the propensity to enjoy or to experience bliss is also natural to the jiva. But the only way it can be expressed properly is by serving the Lord. Then we get the bliss. And when we try to get the enjoyment for ourselves, we end up with material happiness and material distress. And we get all these other side effects like envy, lust, anger, greed, etc. So therefore, these things are related to the material world. And we can say anger rises from tamagun and passion gives rise to, rajas gives rise to lust, etc. So they're related to the gunas because the jiva, with his desire to enjoy, covered by his gross body and subtle body, contacts objects for his enjoyment, and therefore gets completely tangled up with those things. Yeah? So yes, all these things are related to matter, but it's actually the desire that the jiva to enjoy that causes the jiva to contact all this and end up with lust, anger, and greed. Yes.
Can you explain a little bit, what's the definition of a Vaishnava aparad? Is it just anything that makes a Vaishnava upset?
If the Vaishnava gets upset with another devotee, then we have offended that devotee. That's kind of the general principle. Of course, we know that some devotees get upset very easily and for the wrong reasons, even if they're on a lower level. And the higher we go, the more tolerant and forgiving we are. So we don't experience, you know, people offending us at all, the more advanced we get. So, in all cases, we do have to be careful. The main idea here is in ourself that we don't have bad intentions to harass or cause problem for the devotee. Yeah? So by accident, you do something and some devotee may, because they're sensitive, they get upset by that or whatever. So, yeah, it causes a little problem, but not much. But when we intentionally don't like a devotee and then we do something to harass them or whatever, then that's an intentional apparat. And they, of course, if they are exalted, then they won't get upset by that either. But then our intention is bad. So even if they don't get upset by it, still, we're with our intention, we are somehow attacking them or criticizing them or obstructing them, then we have to suffer that effect. So those effects are more serious, whether the other person is upset or not. Insensitive to apparatus? Or they don't care about committing apparatus. Which one? Well, the devotee by nature should tolerate, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, even second chapter says, you know, hot and cold, etc., tolerate everything. And in Bhagavatam it says the devotee in joy or in suffering, whether he's criticized or praised, he's indifferent to everything. And so in that sense, there should be some indifference to material world and things like that. On the other hand, the devotee is not supposed to tolerate apparat against other devotees. So for material things, yeah, we're kind of indifferent. But to the devotional process and things like that, then we have to be very careful about that.
Hi, Krishna. Krishna Maharaj. Could you say a little bit about, you say Krishna doesn't forgive offenses or apparats. So maybe you could say a little bit about the difference between the devotee committing an offense, an apparat, and someone who is outside the process, who is in total ignorance.
Yeah.
Of what's going on, yeah. Committing a violence or offense against devotees.
Yeah. So one thing about the Lord not forgiving, the process of, let's say, rectifying the offense, if it is, you know, you intentionally do something to a devotee, is you have to go and apologize. I feel repentance, obviously, and then you have to apologize to the person, and he may or may not accept the apology. In any case, if you don't follow that process, when you recognize the apparat, then the apparat stays there and doesn't go away. So Krishna doesn't forgive in that sense. But then Krishna is willing to forgive the apparat if you actually go to the devotee and make amends and apologize, etc. So that's one thing. In the case of devotees committing apparats or materialists committing apparats, obviously the materialists or the demons committing apparats is much more serious because they're very hostile. Now the devotees in general, if they're at least, you know, Madhyama devotees who are somewhat serious, they're not intentionally trying to harass other devotees. We hope not anyway, with such intensity as, you know, someone in the material world. I mean, they really hate devotees or whatever. So they don't have such intensity, so therefore not so serious. But we do have to be careful that, you know, the devotees don't hold any animosity towards other devotees, which is unjust or whatever. No. If a devotee does some bad activities and then we have to criticize or, you know, point out the fault, okay, that's another thing. But to unjustly, without any let's say, a good cause to start criticizing devotees, or we make up faults or whatever. That's where the problem comes. So by doing that, we're actually going back like the materialists, and you know, we're feeding our material propensities that way of, you know, lust, anger, greed, envy, pratishta, all these things. We're feeding that by the criticism. So it's kind of similar to the you know, demoniac mentality or whatever. So we have to be careful of that in our inner devotional service.
It's something that Vaisheshika Prabhu advised devotees, that if there is confrontation, and I know Mother Kalangana, where they say, always take the humble position.
Yeah.
It's because what happens is the confrontation then leads to, that's what leads to offenses.
Yeah, more.
So Mother Kalangana would always just bow her head and not say anything. And she went through such difficulties. But they're always right, we're always wrong. And they walk away. And I remember one particular occasion, there was somebody started calling Krishna a murderer. And he was almost hysterical. The one thing I did was then just turn away.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't argue with him. Because his offenses would have got so great.
Yeah.
You know, you have to walk away.
Yeah. So, of course, Lord Chaitanya says we should be humbler than a blade of grass and more tolerant than a tree. Give all respect to all living entities, not respect for ourselves. So that's actually essential to the process of bhakti. So if we're really doing bhakti, then when these things happen, we're going to tolerate an awful lot, take a humble position.
You were speaking about how the devotee shouldn't tolerate criticism of another devotee. But also in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, it said that if two devotees are fighting and if you take the side of one, then you're destroyed. So I was wondering, how do we manage this situation?
Yeah, we should not encourage more, taking sides this way and that way. Yeah. Okay, I guess we can end here. Okay, Hare Krishna. Namaste. Good.